kept me curled up, knees tight against my ribs. The tension inside me was growing unbearable, like a wire pulled tight. Nothing I did seemed to relieve it. I was aware of the pressure every waking moment. One afternoon, I heard sandals slapping the hallway floor outside my room. I steeled myself, waiting to see who was coming. It was Abdullah. He came directly to my mat. "How are you?" he said. Then, "I want, pull it up." He wanted the red dress pulled toward my waist so he could undo my jeans. I rolled onto my back, turned my head to the side, and squeezed my eyes shut. Then he was on top of me, and I was hating him with every molecule in my body. I wanted him to die. I put my hands against his chest to create a sort of barrier between us. Something in me howled. I could feel what was happening. The bow of my mind had reached its snapping point. I couldn't lift myself away from it, couldn't lessen the tension. I couldn't stand another second of this life. I was collapsing into insanity. I felt it. My head pounded as it arrived. Bracing myself, I pushed my hands harder against Abdullah's chest, and something happened. A searing blast of heat hit my palms, a delivery of some sort, a quick shock followed by a strange, spreading calm. I wasn't in my body anymore. I was somewhere else, my mind dissipating into a vast canopy, a thing hung over this place, stretched like a collection of tiny lights. Images ran past me, scenes from stories Abdullah had told me months earlier. His life was abruptly, seamlessly on display. I saw him as a young boy running toward an explosion, realizing that his beloved aunt had been standing at its center. I saw him collecting and carrying home what was left of her, a piece of one leg, not knowing what else to do. I saw him a few years later hiding behind a truck as a group of gunmen went from house to house massacring his neighbors. For one split second, I knew his suffering. It had assembled itself and looped through me in a rush. Its absolute clarity made me gasp. It was anguish, accrued over the brief span of his life. It was rage and helplessness. It was a little kid hiding behind a truck. This was the person who was hurting me, his sadness trenched beneath mine. When he was gone, I lay on the mat, my body hurting the same way it always did. I felt completely confused. What had just passed? I had no idea. Whatever it was, it unsettled me. In the moment, it had felt perfectly rational and even profound, like the lifting of some great curtain, the flash of a hidden truth. But now my mind started to analyze, attempting to hammer what had happened into words and structure, and the thing itself resisted. I couldn't shape it or explain it. I could only live with it, this new feeling, complicated as it was. In the end, though, it helped me, because with it, I began to nurture something I'd never expected to feel in captivity, a seedling of compassion for those boys. Chapter 38. Omar. The war around us was getting worse. Somalia in 2009 was in political flux. The president of the shaky transitional government had resigned abruptly in 2008, leaving a power vacuum in Mogadishu. Neighboring Ethiopia, which had spent 2 years trying to prop up the fledgling Somali government, had all but given up, calling its troops back home. Battles raged across the country as Al-Shabaab and other Islamist groups competed for authority, letting loose on one another in block-by-block street fights, while a few thousand African Union peacekeepers, mostly from Uganda and Burundi, tried to protect what was left of the functioning government in Mogadishu. All I knew is that the fighting appeared to follow us. The neighborhood surrounding the dark house at first was quiet, but after a month or so, I began to hear mortar blasts and ricocheting gunfire almost daily, the bam and zing of a rising turf war. Its closeness must have worried our captors because they moved us, this time to a house that looked more like a mansion. I rode in the car next to Nigel. He stared wanly ahead, his shoulders hunched, his whole body seeming deflated. When I turned toward him and said, "Are you okay?" Young Yahya hit me on the side of the head. "No talk," he screamed. I didn't speak again. The new house was shaped like a giant L, its yard enclosed by high walls. It was bigger and grander than anything I'd seen in Somalia, with an ornate front door made of wood and a box-like outbuilding in one corner of the scruffy yard. Positive House, I would come to call it. Abdullah and Yahya led me down a tiled hallway. I moved awkwardly in my chains, my ribs aching, my posture stooped. During my time in the dark, I'd been kicked in the mouth so hard that two of my back teeth had come loose. One had fallen out, but the other now had abscessed, leaving the gums swollen, my jaw shooting with pain that worsened as I moved. But entering the new house, I was also wildly alert, my senses assaulted by the change of scenery. We were in a family home, it was clear, a place that, unlike the others we'd stayed, felt only recently vacated. The air bore a certain freshness. The floor tiles were white and clean. I could almost feel the energy, the prosperity of the people who'd left it behind. We passed rooms filled with furniture. I saw a couch and a lamp. I saw a plush-looking mattress with a wooden headboard behind it. At the end of the long hallway, we turned right onto a shorter hall, and I was pushed through the very last door on the left-hand side. It was a small room with a window covered by a set of heavy shutters. In one corner was a straight-backed metal chair with a missing leg and a ripped fabric seat cushion, its yellow stuffing spilling outward. A rolled-up Persian-style carpet lay like a long cigar against the wall. Tacked to the right of the window was a large, brightly colored poster, laminated in plastic, depicting a suspension bridge. I'd seen posters like this many times before, hung in the cheap restaurants and guest houses of the backpacker ghettos I once frequented, showing landmarks and nature scenes whose hues had been photoshopped to a bursting technicolor unreality. I'd always found them mockable for their artificiality. But here this was, pinned to the wall before me, a giant bridge spanning a giant river with flamboyantly green headlands rising toward an orchid-colored sky at sunset. I was starved for every color it held, transfixed by the geometry of cables and girders. I studied the bridge, the chair, the carpet, the window leaking light along the edges of the shutters. All of it was beautiful. All of it carried something loosely hopeful. The boys had tossed my foam mat into the room, along with two plastic bags containing my belongings and sheets, and departed. It seemed this would be my new home. As I set about making the bed, I noticed something sticking out from beneath the rolled-up carpet, a bit of paper, what looked to be the corner of an envelope. My heart fluttered at the sight. I don't know what I thought would be in that envelope. A message for me? A map? It didn't matter. The paper, whatever it was, didn't come from my captors. It was left by other people, leading other lives. It carried with it a residue of normalcy. With shaking fingers, I pulled the thing toward me. It was indeed an envelope, a slim one with a folded-down top, the kind you got when picking up prints at a photo store. Inside was a single-color photo, a passport picture of a boy bordered in white, and a slip of paper with some Somali words written on it, including what must have been the boy's name, Omar. He looked about 9 years old. He wore a collared shirt and a sober expression. He had short brambly hair and dark circles under his big brown eyes. His neck was long, like a flower stem. Beneath the seriousness, he seemed sweet and eager, as if trying to appear older than his age, worthy of whatever journey might have prompted the photo session. I stared at Omar's picture for 10 seconds, then put it back in the envelope and left it on the floor as if it were radioactive. Which it kind of was. Almost certainly my captors would see it as a document, and documents were a problem. After I finished putting the sheet over my foam mat, I lay down. Then I reached for the envelope again. It was irresistible. The boy was irresistible. I held the little photo out in front of my face so I could better see Omar, and he, I imagined, could better see me. We examined each other solemnly, and then, worried that someone would surface at my door, I put him back in his envelope and stashed it beneath my mat. My pulse raced. I knew if the boys found me with it, I'd be beaten. Some part of me couldn't let go of the photo, though. I felt like Omar was mine to protect. I thought of us as allies. He'd left his house, and now, in the twisted logic of his country, I was here, in his place. It was possible that his daddy was a militia leader and he himself was already bent on jihad, but something, maybe desperation, told me otherwise. Every few minutes, unable to stop myself, I took Omar's picture out from beneath my mat and looked at it again, trying to memorize the details of his boyish face, his narrowed chin, the clamshell bend of his mouth, all the while paying attention to the doorway. I had just slipped the envelope back into its hiding place when Abdullah and Yahya returned. Abdullah stared at me fiercely, seeming to read the guilt on my face, and ordered me to my feet. I was sure he was about to do one of his document searches, but instead he gestured that I should gather my things. They decided to move me to a new room in a different part of the house. The next room would have no furniture in it, only a cardboard box filled with white porcelain dishes and a bouquet of plastic blue flowers set on top of it. Its doorway looked out onto a patch of hallway wall. There I'd find, nailed into the concrete, a different, oversaturated, cheesy in another lifetime poster, this one showing a pile of fruit. A pineapple, red apples, bright bananas, and a dewy pyramid of bulbous green grapes. All of it luridly bright, heaped against a sky blue backdrop. The sight would be punishing. I'd stare at it from my mat. It would sharpen my already vicious hunger for days to come until finally, either sensing the lust it pulled out of me or worried that the image offended Allah, one of the boys would take the poster down. But before that, I was ordered to gather my things and move from the first room. I had to figure out what to do with my contraband. I spent my last 30 seconds in Omar's room caught in a heart-thudding, should I or shouldn't I crisis as, under the gaze of Abdullah and Yahya, I slowly pulled the sheet from my mat, trying to buy some time. The envelope with the picture lay beneath the mat. Using the sheet for a screen, I thought I could reach down and snatch it up, attempting to toss it into one of my plastic bags before either of the boys noticed. I could take Omar with me, which would make me happy and also might be safer than exposing the envelope where it lay on the floor, a sure giveaway that I'd been hiding it. There was no time to ponder. In one quick swoop, I picked up the bags and the foam mat while making, in my chains, what passed for a fast and obedient bolt toward the door. This left Omar where he was, somewhere between the broken chair and the carpet, under the gaze of the Technicolor bridge, face up in his paper envelope, abandoned a second time. Leaving the room, I didn't look back, and thankfully, neither did my captors. Chapter 39. Positive House. We stayed in Positive House for about 2 months, and there too the fighting crept closer. I could hear gun battles outside my window. The boys seemed wound up by the war. A new president had been appointed to run the transitional government in Mogadishu, a former high school geography teacher named Sheikh Sharif Ahmed, who, a few years earlier, had helped build an alliance of Islamist groups in Mogadishu and managed briefly to keep the city's warlords in line. The boys had been thrilled with their new president. The week Sheikh Sharif was elected by the Somali parliament, back in the Dark House, Abdullah had broken from routine and spent a few minutes talking to me about how excited they were to have the Ethiopian troops gone and a strong Muslim leader in office. The struggle was over, he said. Thousands of people who'd fled Mogadishu were moving back home. Sheikh Sharif would unite all the Islamic factions using Sharia law. The fighting will stop, Abdullah had predicted, sounding confident. The prospect of peace seemed to please him. I trusted that the new political order meant something hopeful for me and Nigel as well. But all I'd been able to hear through the walls of the Dark House was more fighting. What I learned when we got to Positive House was that not only had the boys lost faith in the new president quickly, they now saw him as an enemy. Their optimism had flipped into something darker. In Sheikh Sharif's first weeks in office, he'd established himself as a moderate and, more horrifyingly to my captors, a coalition builder, open to seeking support from foreign governments, saying he wanted to make peace with Ethiopia, a predominantly Christian nation. In Positive House, the boys docked themselves in front of the radio in the afternoons, listening to the news on the BBC Somali World Service. The war was escalating rather than dwindling, the hardline Islamists pitted against the new president and his ideas about peace. Al-Shabaab and Hizbul Islam, another insurgent group, were launching fresh attacks against the African Union peacekeeping troops protecting the government in the capital. The peacekeepers were fighting back. After a roadside bomb hit one of their trucks, African Union soldiers were said to have opened fire on a crowd, killing more than a dozen bystanders. With this, the boys declared the new president a kafir, an unbeliever, and the jihad fully back on. They were talking to me again, more than they had since the escape attempt. All the rules held, I was not allowed to sit up on my mat without permission. I was expected to lie only on my side, but the boys' hatred had realigned itself somewhat. They seemed more focused on politics, less bent on making me suffer. They kept the windows of my room shut against the daylight, even stuffing the cracks with plastic bags to blot out any stray lines of sun. None of it worked, though. I could see and hear more than ever. Darkness for me was now relative. Romeo began to make long visits to the house, staying for 3 or 4 days at a time and bringing with him a different energy. As a leader, he granted new freedoms to the boys and to Captain Skids. All of them now got full days and nights off going home to see their families. They'd come back with new haircuts, in fresh shirts, and good spirits. Sometimes they arrived with a bag of fruit or pieces of fried fish to share with everyone. Every so often, as a treat, they'd bring me something, a toffee or a ripe purple passion fruit sliced open at the middle. From my mat, I could see out my door and down the hallway, catching a glimpse of the room on the opposite side where Nigel was kept. It looked big, like a living room, and was furnished. I could see a brown couch against one wall. The boys regularly spent time in there talking with Nigel. I could overhear snippets of the conversation. Nigel told them about how he liked to build houses, saying he wanted to build houses in Somalia even. I heard him ask if he could sleep on the couch, and I heard them answer no. They did, however, let him remove the cushions and make a bed for himself on the floor. They seemed frequently to discuss girls and Islam. "We call it masturbation," I heard Nigel say loudly one day. The boys were tittering. They were teasing one another about who did it, making jokes about the extra bathing required by Islam after ejaculation. One of them made exaggerated sounds of orgasm, causing more laughter. With Romeo in the house and the war in full swing around us, Abdullah was permitted to take on daytime soldiering jobs, going out once or twice a week and joining militias fighting the African Union troops. It was part of his jihad. Among the boys in the house, he seemed the only one keen on street fighting. He'd get a call in the evening from some commander and spend hours readying himself for the following day. He'd fiddle with his gear, sometimes lugging it into my room to show off. These were the rare moments when I could converse with Abdullah, when he'd allow me to ask a question or comment on what he said. He'd stand in my doorway and clean his gun with an oily rag, talking all the while about how, God willing, he would kill a lot of enemies the next day. "Inshallah," he said on one of the first nights we had this exchange, "tomorrow I am dead." I reacted automatically with an objection, not because I didn't want him to die, but because it seemed the only decent response. "Don't say that," I said. "You don't want to die. Think of your mother. She'd be so sad." Abdullah shook his head at me. "No, it is best way." He added one of his favorite comments, "You are a bad Muslim." He took his gun and walked out the door. A few minutes later, he reappeared, carrying Nigel's blue leather copy of the Quran. Setting the gun down and seating himself next to my mat, he paged through the book, finally alighting on the right passage. He pointed to the relevant line on the English side of the page. "Therefore, let those who fight in the way of Allah, who sell this world's life for the hereafter." I'd read it before. I knew the boys believed that paradise would be their reward, that in a straight-up trade, there was no arguing that any sacrifice made in their hot, hungry country wasn't worth an eternal seat on a jeweled couch in Jannah. This, for them, was the creed. Abdullah was reminding me that I was supposed to believe it, too. At 24, Romeo was not only older than the boys, but seemed to come from a different world altogether. He was sophisticated, speaking English without effort, in a clipped, bookish accent that resembled the way I'd heard English spoken in India. He wore jeans and a nice-looking scarf and cologne that smelled expensive. He claimed to have a university degree in engineering and spoke of his travels to Kenya. In the afternoons, he visited me, sitting cross-legged against the wall opposite my mat. He looked me directly in the eye and punctuated his speech with well-worn Western phrases. "You know what I mean?" he'd say after telling me something. "You get my point?" He did not strike me as friendly, but talking to me seemed to feed his ego. He told me he was the 28th child in his family. His father had married 4 women. After his father died, everyone except Romeo had fled Mogadishu for the northern city of Hargeisa. He said that he himself was unmarried, focused on his education. He was taking correspondence courses through the University of Yemen. He wanted to get another degree in information technology and work with computers. He was applying to graduate schools. "You look very nice," he said one day, "very healthy." He leaned in closer. "You see, before we took you, you did not look good. You were looking very bad." He pointed to his forehead and then toward mine, mimicking the motion of eyebrow plucking, which I knew was an act of vanity forbidden by the Hadith. In my previous life, I'd been an assiduous, even zealous eyebrow plucker. After 8 months in captivity, I knew my brows were thick and straight as caterpillars. Romeo was voicing his approval. "Allah makes you very beautiful," he said. "When you leave here, a man will be very lucky to have you as his wife." I would have given anything, then more than ever, to go at my eyebrows with a pair of tweezers. I was vain. I was still vain, stubbornly vain. I'd wrought in the hellfires for an arch in my eyebrow. The truth was, I was an unsightly wreck. My body was deteriorating. I had broken teeth from some of the beatings. My ribs never stopped aching before they were kicked again, and making it worse, I developed a bad cough. My hair was falling away in clumps. The dirty water cramped my stomach. The itchy skin fungus had spread along the left side of my face, down my neck and chest. My skin oozed with pus. But I was past feeling sorry for myself. I began to make declarations, piggybacking them onto my regular silent talks with myself in the evenings. I'd made it out of the dark house, I reminded myself, and I'd get out of this place. I summoned all my confidence and directed it at my body. Rather than thinking, as I often had, "I hope my stomach stops cramping and maybe tomorrow my diarrhea will go away," I got bold. I stated everything like a truth, a proclamation. "My digestive system is healthy. I get nourishment from the food I'm eating. My skin is healthy, smooth, and healed." I went through it daily, a point-by-point scan of my body, an incantation, a resurrection. "My eyesight is good. My teeth are solid. My hair is full. My mind is strong." I focused a lot on my reproductive system, the part of me I worried about most. I hadn't had a period since being captured. I felt pains in places I couldn't identify. I tried not to think about them. "My organs are protected," I told myself. "My ovaries still work. I am okay." One morning, Skids came to my room and dropped a small plastic bag on the floor. Inside was a blister pack of capsule pills, sheathed in a narrow box that bore a picture of bananas and oranges on the front. Its information panel appeared to be written in Chinese. Half the pills were gone. At the bottom of the bag, I found a square of paper, a form from a pharmacy printed in English and filled out in pen. It read, "Name, Saro. Age, 34. There was a check next to the word female. It was a gift. The medicine was a gift, but to know her name meant even more. Saro, age 34. It had to be her, the woman whose retching cough had penetrated my nights at the dark house, the otherwise silent cook for my captors. She'd heard me coughing. She wanted to help. She had pressed those tablets into the captain's hands, I was sure of it, telling him that I should have them. He might have balked at first, but she'd insisted, and he'd relented. I saw the whole story in my mind. She cared, and that mattered. I took Saro's pills, one every morning. They didn't seem to help, but at least she and I had a bond. The bathroom I used at Positive House was outdoors. Getting there involved a long walk down the main hallway, a turn to the right, and a trip down the shorter hall past Omar's room, now being used as a kitchen, and then through a door to a bathroom stall in the yard. The boys had given me a pair of shoes, a set of oversized yellow flip-flops with Happy 2008 and a bunch of balloons printed on the sole, but half worn away with age. As I moved, I kept my eyes on the ground, followed closely each time by one of the boys. My gaze was supposed to be always lowered. A few times, passing Omar's room, I'd seen a set of feet belonging to the cook, Saro, age 34, as she paused in the doorway, evidently watching me. She was close enough to touch. I could see the flowered hemline of her dress, long enough to graze the floor and hide her feet, in keeping with Islamic custom. One day, overcome by a burst of courage and a deeper longing to know the woman who'd shown me such kindness, I glanced up at her face. She was beautiful, strikingly so. Her body was willowy and tall, her features finely sculpted. Her eyes were dark, her cheeks sloping, her chin a slender point. She had the same angular face and elegant carriage as the Somali fashion model, Iman. She wore a light brown scarf wrapped tightly over her head. When our eyes met, Sarah let out a gasp. Her hand flew up to cover her mouth. We'd lived under the same roof for several months, but this was to be our first and only contact. Her eyes widening in alarm, she looked towards Yahya, who had been trailing me to the bathroom with his gun, and uttered a Somali word that seemed to indicate her state of surprise, something akin to, "Oh!" It wasn't a betrayal, but it certainly wasn't an act of allegiance. If anything, it told me she was as afraid of the boys as I was, that despite being willing to share her medicine, she wouldn't, even for an instant, be caught conspiring with me. She didn't dare. Without hesitation, Yahya hit me from behind, landing a punch on my back and another to my head. My gaze fell again to Saro's hemline against the floor. Later that day, Jamal and Abdullah would come to my room and hit me repeatedly as I lay curled in a ball, making me promise never to look up. I wouldn't dare try it again, but I was glad, at least, to have seen her face. Chapter 40, Wife Lessons. "This might be difficult for you," Romeo said to me one afternoon in June, "but this life, it's like this." He snapped his fingers to show no time at all. "And the rewards of paradise are forever." This was meant as encouragement. The idea was that we should hold steady because better things were coming. For my captors, God's plan was unfolding. For me, captivity was a moment, a long moment, that would pass. We all waited on an afterlife. Only I planned to be alive for mine. We had moved again. We were staying a long way from Mogadishu, somewhere near the port city of Kismayu, in the south of Somalia, not far from the border with Kenya. I wasn't supposed to know where we were, but I did. On the drive there, about 12 hours in an SUV piloted by Ahmed, we fishtailed over desert tracks, slamming through ditches and climbing the sides of steep ravines, avoiding the north-south highway altogether. As the boys sat in the two forward seats, their gunmetal clinking in the dark, Nigel and I, too afraid to say even one word to each other, lay jammed in the hatch of the car, stuck between Romeo, who for some reason had volunteered to sit there, and a sloshing 50-gallon drum of fuel. I'd listen to the boys murmuring with excitement at the promise of the unknown. It was as if they were on a school field trip. It seemed as far away from home as they'd ever been. With the moon coasting alongside us, they craned their necks to see out the window. "Kismayu," they were saying quietly, betraying the secret without realizing it. "Kismayu, Kismayu." In Kismayu, I could taste the Indian Ocean on my tongue. Its humidity coated my skin, causing the shackles on my legs to rust, leaving florid streaks on my ankles. It was never in sight, the ocean, but I could tell it was nearby, reaching east toward Australia, sprinkled, as I imagined it, with yachts and tanker ships and islands full of people going about their business. At night, storms swept overhead, dousing the place with rain. For weeks, Romeo and Ahmed had been threatening to sell me and Nigel to Al-Shabaab. I was sure they'd brought us here to complete the deal. Kismayu was known to be a Shabaab stronghold. The thought of having to live under new captors and new rules, among the most extreme extremists in the country, filled me with anxiety. After a few days, though, I realized that we'd moved to Kismayu only to get away from the fighting. We'd spent two nights in a second-floor apartment in the heart of the city, and were now living in an empty office building, a place with five small rooms, located away from the downtown bustle, a place we would later refer to as the beach house. My captors were likely paying protection money to Al-Shabaab in order to stay. Several times during our trip through the desert, we'd had to stop so skids could hand cash to the various warlords who controlled the road. Nigel had been put in a room across from mine. It was hot enough that the boys didn't loiter outdoors. Instead, they camped in the reception area just beyond my door, closer than they'd ever been. They kept their Qurans stacked on a battered-looking receptionist desk in the corner. All of us shared a bathroom with a squat toilet, spattered in rank from its previous tenants. The water supply was a waist-high cistern, its surface wriggling with mosquito larvae. Romeo, it seemed, had moved in with us for good. Over 10 months, the faces had changed, with different men on duty at different times. A few of our captors disappeared altogether, vanishing like plumes of smoke. Ali, the man who'd been our main guard in the first days of captivity, the one who'd taken credit for our conversion to Islam, had left after only a few weeks. Ismail, the youngest soldier of all, who said he was 14 but looked closer to 11, who looked terrified any time he came near us, also had slipped away during the first month. As winter passed into spring, we saw less and less of Donald Trump. Young Yahya, whose wife had a new baby at home, stayed a few weeks in Kismayu and then departed, never to return. Saro, age 34, my silent female ally, had not made the trip south at all. I had only the vaguest of understandings of what knit our captors together. Ismail had no immediate family to return to. I knew that because very early on, when Nigel and I were kept in the same room, Abdullah had made Ismail pull up his pant leg one day, showing us how his entire calf muscle had been stripped off in an explosion, his lower leg shaped like a mostly eaten drumstick. The boy then lifted his shirt, exposing flame-like scars that wrapped around his torso, the skin puckered and tawny and hard to even look at. Abdullah had explained that Ismail was the only person in his family to survive a mortar attack. He was an orphan, and as happened with a lot of orphan boys in Mogadishu, he'd been pulled into the group, promised shelter, food, and community. After Ismail disappeared, I'd asked Romeo what had happened to him, and he'd had to think about it a minute, not recollecting the boy's name. Ultimately, he'd shrugged, saying that probably Ismail had been passed on to a new militia. Shuffled, as it were, into a different deck of cards. It was difficult to understand how our group functioned, who was pulling the strings, who recruited the boys and paid for food, who had made the decision to move us to Kismayu. Who, I wondered, would profit most if our ransom was paid? If it wasn't, who made the decision on when to give up, when to kill us, or to set us free? Much later, I would read about the rogue and rough-seeming Somali pirate operations in the Gulf of Aden, in many cases run with the acumen and polish of mini-corporations, complete with investors, accountants, and structured payrolls based on the net ransom. One journalist studied a successful 75-day ship hijacking operation with a ransom of $1.8 million and determined that about half went to the financiers, while middlemen, presumably men like Adam, Donald Trump, and Romeo, made more like $60,000, and guards got something closer to $12,000. In a country with an average per capita income of $266 per year, it was very good money, but only if everything went the right way. One afternoon, Romeo showed up in my doorway to announce some big news. He'd applied and been accepted to a university in New York City to study information technology. He'd be leaving for America in a matter of months. He had many questions for me. Had I been to New York? How cold would it be there? Did I think people in America would be able to understand his accent? He planned to live with relatives who were already there. My ransom, he said, would fund his tuition. Inshallah, he added, if Allah permits it. He'd taken new interest in my education as a Muslim, carrying Nigel's English language Quran into my room and delivering long sermons about devotion and destiny. Happy to have access to a book, any book, I was again inhabiting the role of eager student. When Romeo was present, I was allowed to sit up and talk. I felt human. His presence was also protective, keeping Abdullah and the others away. Once or twice, he opened the Quran and showed me the lines covering those whom your right hand possesses, which, to his way of thinking, was a category that included me. He and the other leaders knew I was being abused by some of the boys in the house, but even while viewing themselves as too dignified to participate in such behavior, they believed I was not to question what the boys did. It was my lot as a captive. As it was with every person on earth, my fate had been written into my soul when I was in my mother's womb. Allah will decide when it is over for you, he said. In the meantime, he was convinced that Allah was going to come through on his college plan. Why, I asked him, would you want to study in the country of infidels? I'd heard him refer to the United States this way many times before. The question seemed to make Romeo momentarily uncomfortable, as if he recognized the hypocrisy, but he bounced back, his tone languid and even. Allah says we can go to these countries if there is a purpose, he said. If we can take something from that country, and we can then give it to the Islamic community, then it is good. Sometimes he would venture into a coyer sort of conversation. Do you think Somali men are handsome? He asked one day. Are they better than men in your country? Outside, a rare breeze blew, thrushing over the tin roof. Romeo sat across from my mat with his knees splayed and the Quran perched on his lap. When I didn't answer, he tried a different tack. Are there any of the soldiers you would like to marry? By soldiers, he meant the boys. I told him no, I never wanted to marry any of those soldiers. He smiled, raising his eyebrows. His voice was sonorous, wheedling. If I asked you to marry me, would you be happy? I noted that he didn't ask whether I'd say yes. I'd sensed this sort of proposition coming, but hearing him say it made me quake with fear. If I were forced into some sort of formal marriage, I might never get away. I'm not in a position to make a decision about marriage, I said, shaking my head to emphasize that there was no possibility whatsoever. I'm a prisoner. Ah, yes, Romeo said, but this is where Allah has decided you should be. He folded his hands in his lap and looked at me matter-of-factly. Do not fight it, Amina. For Romeo, the ongoing conversation about marriage seemed in part an active fantasy, a way to pass the time. Even he, I suspected, got tired of talking round the clock about the Quran. He described a kind of win-win situation in which he collected a fat payoff and a bride to boot. He said that if it were up to him, he'd marry me right away, except that everybody in the group had too much riding on the ransom. So, the program, as he called it, would need to be resolved. Once it was, I could live in his mother's house in Hargeisa, he said, even while he was at school in New York. He added that because I was white, I would probably have to stay hidden in a room. A big room, he said, as if the idea might thrill me, so that I wouldn't be harassed or kidnapped. If you were the mother of my children, he told me, you would teach my sons about jihad. You would encourage them to fight jihad in Somalia or another country. You would teach them the Quran, and you would be very, very good with that. His flattery was never comforting. One afternoon, he leaned in close and pointed out a certain verse in the Quran. It was one of the ones I'd read plenty of times before. Your wives are a tilth for you, so go into your tilth when you like. A tilth, as I understood it, was a field to be plowed. Romeo smiled. Do you know, when you are my wife, what this will mean? My heart sank. Yes, but I don't want to discuss these things, I told him. His term for sex was making enjoyable. Inshallah, when you are my wife, we will be making enjoyable all the time, Romeo told me that day, because I am wanting enjoyable all the time. I kept my eyes on the floor and said nothing until he stood up and left the room. In the beach house, when Romeo wasn't around, all I could do was listen. In the reception area just past my door, I could hear the boys coughing and spitting. I listened to them wash and pray. I knew when they were cleaning their teeth with fibrous acacia sticks, or telling jokes, or sunk into a collective state of dull misery. I could hear when one of the boys snapped his fingers, summoning Nigel to get up and do his ablutions. Much of the noise in the house came from their cell phones. Everyone had one. A couple of the boys owned two. These were high-end phones, some with touch screens, bought with money they'd earned fighting prior to our kidnapping. Because we had no electricity, someone would carry the phones to the market late in the day to be charged at a kiosk, left overnight in exchange for a few coins. Rarely were the phones used for actual conversation. Jamal occasionally had short, awkward dialogues with Hamdi. Only the captain and Romeo received regular calls, presumably from the leaders, who had stayed behind in Mogadishu. The boys fiddled endlessly with their phones, changing their ringtones, which, given that Sharia law prohibited music, were never musical. They used birds chirping, bells ringing, and children laughing, all of which drove me crazy. Away from the house, they loaded their phones with nasheeds, Arabic chants that extolled the glory of Allah or the virtues of Muhammad. Sometimes the boys would come into my room and show me videos downloaded from Saudi Arabian websites. The videos seemed designed expressly to incite and enrage, showing dead Palestinians and dead Afghans and lots of dead children. There were explosions in Iraq, intercut with video of the World Trade Center buildings collapsing into a haze of yellow dust. There were masked Mujahideen soldiers performing military drills and firing mantis-like grenade launchers against a backdrop of jagged mountain peaks. With Arabic subtitles running along the bottom, one video repeatedly showed George W. Bush announcing, "This crusade, this war on terrorism, is going to take a while." All around the world, Islam was under siege. I was soon able to distinguish between the voices of the individual imams who narrated them against a backdrop of tinny gun blasts and people screaming. I could tell which jihad video was most in vogue at any given time. New videos cycled in and out of our household routine. My God, I remember thinking, these guys spend something like 10 hours a day watching people die on their phones. Through the bars in the window in the beach house bathroom, I could see past the walls of our compound to a green neon light that shone in the distance at night, marking what I guessed was the entrance to a mosque. Every so often, I saw the headlights of a passing car. The weeks blurred. My 28th birthday came and went, though I'd lost track of the individual days. I woke and slept, listening to the thumps of frigate birds landing on the roof. One day, the voice of the Somali newscaster for the BBC threaded through my consciousness as the boys sat gathered around the radio in the next room. Michael Jackson, he was saying. Michael Jackson, Michael Jackson. The singer was dead, but it would be a long while before I knew it. I was beginning to starve. Each morning I was given 3 cubes of animal fat boiled in a weak, oily broth. Sometimes I got a cup of tea. Later in the day, after the evening prayer, I'd get the same thing again, occasionally with a very ripe banana alongside it. At times, instead of 3 cubes of fat, there'd be 2. Once in a while, a day would pass with no food at all. My own body shocked me. My hip bones jutted like chicken wings. I could see each one of my ribs. My breasts had all but disappeared. My chest was no more than a striation of bones. Hunger feels like a rock in your belly, heavy and painful at the edges. Other times my stomach felt like a balloon inflated to almost bursting, filled with a tight, dry emptiness. The ache took over my brain to the point where I wanted to bash my head on something to make it stop. Lying on my mat, I found relief in visiting my house in the sky. I went there and tried to stay as long as I could. Inside the shelter of my mind, I cooked and ate and took care of my body. I made soups, salmon, healthy things. I imagined picking fresh vegetables from a garden or plucking oranges from the laden trees I'd seen long ago in Venezuela. This sustained me. It made all the difference. Still, I needed to get more food. As I had done with other problems, I looked for solutions inside my captor's religion. I had read in the footnotes of my Quran that the Prophet recommended his followers fast on Mondays and Thursdays. It was not obligatory, the way fasting over the month of Ramadan was obligatory, but several of the boys in the house routinely did it, saying it kept them pure. Hassam, one of the more diligent fasters, once explained to me that the Prophet called for his followers to break a fast with bread and dates, but in Somali tradition, they broke it with samosas, which counted as bread. Knowing this, I decided to try something. "Hassam," I said one morning, a Thursday, when he arrived with my morning food, "Allah said it is good for the Muslims to fast. I want to fast to be a better Muslim, like you." He smiled broadly at this, knowing that he got credit with Allah for any uptick in my devotion. "Okay, Amina, it is very good." He left the room, and I could hear him relaying my announcement to the others outside. Jamal and Yusuf both stuck their heads in my door to congratulate me on my decision to fast. I could see they were surprised, but again, my growth as a Muslim gave them more points on Judgment Day. My gamble paid off. I made it through the day, having declined the morning meal, and just before the muezzin called at 6 p.m., Jamal showed up carrying a small plastic bag whose contents I could smell from across the room. Inside the bag were 3 little samosas, deep-fried triangles filled with spiced rice and what seemed to be cabbage. I fasted in order to eat. Sometimes the samosas were warm and delicious, other times they weren't fresh and would make me sick. But either way, it didn't matter. They were nourishment. I began to hear a new voice coming from the boys' phones. This voice was calmer than that of the fiery sermons they played, a man's Arabic alto that rang through the beach house, sometimes broadcast from multiple phones at once. Outside, I heard the same voice being blasted from cars passing by. One afternoon, Romeo came in holding his cell phone and a pad of paper. "Amina," he said almost genially, "I need help to improve my English." Taking a seat on the floor, he handed me the paper and a pen. "You can write down the words for me, in English, and I will practice them. You get my point?" He hit a button on his phone and then pivoted it so I could see the screen. A video began to play. A black screen with some Arabic writing on it faded into a map of Somalia, with a still photo of Osama bin Laden superimposed in one corner. He was dressed in a dark robe with a white cotton scarf draped over his head and shoulders. He held one long finger hoisted in the air. The audio began to play. It was the voice I'd been hearing. Bin Laden had released an audio tape addressing the Mujahideen fighters in Somalia and, for the first time, linking the country's struggle to Al-Qaeda's larger aims. Over the course of several months, the message had gone viral. Everyone around me, I realized, was electrified. "Please," said Romeo, "write the English." I squinted to see the tiny subtitles running across the bottom of his screen and began to write. To my patient, persevering Muslim brothers. The video was 11 minutes long. It would take me almost 3 days to transcribe the whole thing, with Romeo coming and going, sitting by me holding his phone for an hour or so at a time. It had been months since I'd written more than a few words. My hand ached from the effort. Bin Laden was calling the Islamic soldiers to overthrow Sheikh Sharif, the new president, who was barely hanging on as it was. He heaped praise on the Somali fighters and made clear that he saw them as being on the front line of a battleground, protecting their brothers in Palestine, Iraq, and Afghanistan. In an even paternal tone, he railed against the Americans, urging everyone to dig in, to show no tolerance of alliances with the West. Bin Laden spoke, Romeo watched, I wrote, my head bent low over the paper in the dim light of the room. The video played then paused as the words filled pages of the notepad. Bin Laden was warning his Somali brothers against falling prey to peace deals or diplomacy, all the trappings of compromise. How can intelligent people believe that yesterday's enemies, on the basis of religion, can become today's friends? He asked. In other words, a war, once begun, must be seen through to the end. Chapter 41. Everything Has Changed. Romeo's application for a student visa to the United States had been approved. He was in high spirits, asking more questions than ever. How long would the plane ride be? Was it true that girls in New York wore shirts that displayed their bellies? When he came now to give me lessons in Islam, he asked me to help him correct any pronunciation errors in his English, to smooth out the edges of his accent. He bought a special notebook, a thin, cheaply made book with pink and purple cartoon hearts on the cover, asking me to write down the most difficult English words I could think of, terms that might be useful for an eager student wishing to sound intelligent in a new country. It was August. He was supposed to leave in September to begin school. I hoped that would put new pressures on whatever negotiations were happening with my family and Nigel's. In over 3 months at the beach house, though his door was about 8 feet from mine, I caught sight of Nigel only a handful of times. Every so often, when he heard the boys snapping to tell me I could go to the bathroom ahead of the noon prayer, he would crawl forward from his mat and crane his head to see across the narrow hall. The sight of him was a shock, his face thin and haggard, his beard a bushy monstrosity. He wore a sarong and a tank top that hung off his bony shoulders. We peered at each other, mutually heartbroken and helpless. Taking an extra risk one day, Nigel pointed to himself and then to me, making the shape of a heart with his hands. I love you. We've been prisoners for close to a year. Through the window in the bathroom, I watched the season change again, the daily rain slowly lightening to nothing, replaced by the hard-bitten burn of late summer, what Somali people call Haga season. At the mosque in the distance, someone had switched out the entrance light from neon green to a garish, mesmerizing pink. Along with the heat, tension was rising in the house among the boys, frustration laced with futility. Hassam had spent a couple of weeks stricken by malaria. Jamal's wedding to Hamdi had been put on hold indefinitely. Now that Yahya, one of my primary guards, was gone, young Mohammed, one of the more violent members of the group, watched over me with renewed intensity. Money seemed to be running low. The boys complained constantly of their own hunger. I took hope from the fact that Romeo was still talking about New York, as if money for his plane ticket, the money from our ransom, would be coming through any day. As an act of faith, I jotted down words for him to study. Sectarian, I wrote. Parsimonious. Autonomous. I could see that the boys were desperate to be done with our kidnapping, but I couldn't begin to guess at what was happening with the leaders of the group or at home. When I asked about progress, Romeo feigned helplessness, blaming my mother for not paying the ransom. having invested 12 months of time and expense, and having conjured some idea that all Westerners swam in rivers of cash, my captors weren't interested in compromising on money. They were convinced that my mother was the gatekeeper to their fortune. They just needed to find a way to break her down. Only later I would understand how calculating they were, what kind of chess match was being played across continents. At home, my family had given up on the Canadian government, joining with the Brennans to hire an outside kidnap and ransom specialist named John Chase to get us out of Somalia. Attempts at diplomacy and intelligence gathering had yielded no visible progress. The families would need to raise money and strike a deal directly with our captors. At the start of August, they signed a contract with Chase's company, a British-based risk mitigation company called AKE. The two families agreed to split the costs, the ransom and AKE's fee of about $2,000 per day, even if my family needed to borrow money from the Brennans up front and repay them later. Quickly, they began pooling whatever funds they had. After months of not answering her cell phone when Adam called, my mother was back on the job as negotiator, this time with the guidance of Chase and his associates in England, and regular phone input from Nigel's family in Australia. Nigel's sister Nikki was also communicating with Adam. The RCMP operational center in Sylvan Lake had been shut down. My mother rented a basement apartment for herself a few hours away in Canmore. She recorded phone calls with Adam on her own, transmitting them to Chase through encrypted email. On the phone, Adam sounded more bellicose than ever. "The group," he said, "was angry. They would take $2 million and no less." My mother, on behalf of the two families, had made a series of counter-offers, rising in small increments, closely following AKE's advice. Every move was meant to slowly fold our captors into a deal. Chase thought the matter could be settled for about $500,000. On August 2nd, my mother told Adam they could pay $281,000. By the end of the month, she was offering $434,000. None of it was good enough. Adam dug in. The phone calls grew heated. He suggested that I must not be my mother's biological child since she cared so little about me. Fed up with his unwillingness to drop the ransom demand even slightly, my mother at one point accused him of playing games. This ratcheted up Adam's temper even higher, which led to a threat. "I am playing a game?" he said with blistering scorn. "You should see my game." With the start of another Ramadan late in August, I had let my defenses down. It was the holy month, a time of restraint. Sexual activity was forbidden during daylight hours, which helped me feel safer. Through my windows, I could hear nasheeds playing over the mosque loudspeaker. Romeo had left for a while, not saying where he was going. The boy's mood seemed to lighten a little. Skids had received some money and bought everyone new sandals. We were eating better, abstaining from food from dawn until sunset, but then rewarded with fresh sweet dates to break the fast. A couple of the boys would go to the market late in the afternoon and buy a sticky mound of them, delivering a few to me at dusk each day, wrapped in a piece of an English-language newspaper printed in Dubai called the Khalij Times. Back when I'd been trying to freelance as a journalist, I'd pitched stories to an editor there. Now, I read whatever small scrap lay beneath my date, looking for any piece of news I could find. I saw stock market listings and, at one point, a short item from Canada, a story about how rabbits were overpopulating on the University of Victoria campus. With the extra money, Jamal and Hassam had the supplies to prepare an evening meal, usually a dish of red beans and rice they called embola. They'd cook it all afternoon and serve it after the sunset prayer, topped with heaps of white sugar and salt for extra taste. "You like?" Jamal would say, watching me eat, hoping for a compliment. "Is good?" At night, the boys were busy running through their extra sets of prayers, their rest prayers. I'd read about them in the Hadith. Nighttime prayers during Ramadan helped Allah forgive a person his sins. One day, things shifted abruptly. Three of the boys, Abdullah, Muhammad, Jamal, came into my room looking grave. Abdullah barked an order telling me to stand up. They were all business, avoiding eye contact with me. They had me walk to the middle of the room and lie face down, my forehead pressed against the concrete floor. Abdullah lifted the blue-flowered sheet from my mat. Standing over me, he used the sheet to tie my wrists behind my back. A minute later, he adjusted it, loosening and sliding the sheet so that it sat at my